Well, good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming out tonight. I know that there are no presidential speeches tonight that we have to compete with, so that's good for us. Welcome to the Alturas Institute. As many of you know, the Alturas Institute is an organization dedicated to promoting civic education, the Constitution, gender equality, and equal protection of the law. And I know all of those issues are very, very important to you, as they are to Americans across the country. I'm very happy that you're here tonight and hope that you come out each and every Wednesday for the rest of this month as we begin this new series on American democracy. Over the next 4 weeks, we're going to talk about the origin and development of American democracy, some of the threats and challenges to democracy. As you know from reading newspapers and magazines and watching television shows, there are great fears being expressed by Americans from coast to coast about the quality, the vitality, even the future of American democracy. One major magazine, The Atlantic magazine, had a title that asked, is democracy dying? And one reason we ask these questions is that we can observe all around us that there are ongoing threats against democracy, against constitutional principles, democratic norms, the great institutions that have established what we like to refer to as this shining city on a hill. So we have a great many questions to turn to over the next 4 weeks. And I do want to remind you that we encourage lots of questions. We'll talk for about 45 minutes, and then we'll turn over the microphone to you and hope you have a lot of good questions. And for the students here tonight, thanks for coming out, and I hope you'll ask those good, troubling questions. We like those. Our beginning question is about democracy. Is America a democracy or a republic? You know that in the editorial pages here in the Post-Register, there has been rather a vigorous discussion and debate over the last couple of months, which is nice to add some local flavor to this discussion. So let me begin by asking you, is America a democracy or a republic? Grenada or Granada? Tomato or tomato? At the beginning, after the framers of the Constitution had produced the Constitution and closed their doors on September 17, 1787, many of the framers, and indeed Americans across the country, referred to America as a democratic republic. It was the custom of the time to refer to America as a democratic republic, and indeed many referred to America as a democracy. Men as different in their worldview and their taste for government as Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Paine agreed that America was a democratic republic. Many even went so far as to refer to America as a democracy. There was the view, however, in America that whatever the nature of democracy was in America in 1787, it was not quite like the pure democracies that existed in the in Athens or in the other Greek city-states in the 5th century B.C., or even those that had existed in New England towns during the Revolutionary period. So one of the great issues that we want to address tonight, and certainly one of the issues that Americans were concerned about in the 1780s and even before that, was what do we mean by democracy? So to start our story, let's turn the clock back to the 5th century B.C. to understand how the world understood that term democracy, because it's important not only for us, but because those who founded our nation took their understanding of what constitutes a democracy from the Athenians in the 5th century B.C. Whenever Americans began to talk about that term, they always referred to the great Athenian democracy, which was understood to be a direct democracy. In the letters, in the correspondence, in the speeches,
By many of our founders, they referred to the Athenian democracy as a pure democracy. Direct democracy, pure democracy, they were synonyms. What was up with that? Our American founders, like writers in England and in European nations, for that matter, understood a direct democracy to be a system of government in which people not only participated, not only had representatives, but in fact participated in the administration of government. It was, in the view of Algernon Sidney, one of the great Whig writers in the 17th century in England, who said, in a democracy, the people are governing themselves directly. Or James Otis, one of our great original thinkers about American constitutional democracy, said, it's a system in which people will make the decisions governing their lives. So let's take a look at some of the hallmarks of the Athenian democracy to understand how James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, and the boys understood democracy. The great hallmark of the Athenian democracy was that, in fact, as Aristotle described it, was that democracy is a government of the many. And what that meant for him was that it would be government primarily by the poor. What an interesting concept. Aristotle, the greatest champion of all the Greek philosophers who wrote about democracy, said, a democracy is a government of the many, by which he meant the poor. And he said that because most people were poor by comparison to the wealthy. And the only way that Athens could succeed in promoting democracy was to assure a voice for the poor people. And that concept drove the Athenians to create some of their most dramatic, iconic institutions. Consider, for example, in a direct democracy, the Athenians did not believe in voting. How interesting, because we Americans take democracy to be the hallmark of our democracy. We vote. If the Athenians didn't vote, what did they substitute? They substituted the device of the lot, L-O-T. And that simply meant that in Athens, all the male citizens, yes, they were sexist, all the male citizens' names were listed on a city registry. Athens was maybe 50,000 people, roughly the size of Idaho Falls. The names of male citizens were listed on the city registry, and an official, rather like a city clerk, simply went down the list and checked the names off of citizens. And when their name was checked, it meant this was the office they would fill, usually for a very short period of time, 6 months, maybe 9 months. Others would serve in what was called the ecclesia, the Greek word for legislature. And the idea was to be all-inclusive, to get as many people as possible participating in the governance of the citizens' lives, in the direct governance of the citizens' lives. In order to promote that theory, the Greeks actually introduced the idea of subsidizing farmers. What an interesting idea. They had to subsidize farmers because farmers could not afford to leave their farms, their vineyards, their farms. And so the Greeks introduced the practice of paying people to go to the farms to work while the owner of the farm could come serve in a governmental capacity of 30 days, of 60 days, of 90 days, whatever it happened to be. What an interesting, very progressive way of trying to encourage the participation of all people. What was the great urge to have participation by all people? Why not just the wise, the virtuous, the particularly useful citizens, as Plato would have had it? Because the Greeks were interested in hearing all viewpoints, because they said, if you vote, the only people who will be elected will be the rich, just the wealthy. How did they know that 2,500 years ago? Aristotle would say, now look, there's nothing wrong with being wealthy. We all aspire to great wealth. But in a democracy, if the only people who are serving in a governmental capacity are those who are wealthy themselves, then the laws will reflect the values of those who write them. And as Aristotle pointed out, we want laws that promote the general happiness or the general good of all the people. And the only way to achieve that state is to bring in many, many voices so as to promote robust discussion and debate in the ecclesia. What a people. What a progressive view. What an idea at that time. And Athens, by the way, stood alone. The other city-states were autocratic. Their great enemy, Sparta, for example, was not interested in democracy. So the Athenian dream of a democracy then rested on the device of the lot, not the idea of voting. Everybody was to participate. And when I say everybody, think of the Greek ethos that was at work here. Aristotle said, perhaps some of you know this famous quote, Aristotle said, in a democracy, only gods and beasts dwell outside the polis. Think about that. Only gods and beasts dwell outside the polis, the Greek word for city. Because if you were an Athenian, it meant you not only wanted to participate, you felt it. To be an Athenian meant that you participated in government. And the only people who did not participate were gods or beasts, which might mean hermits, those who were a recluse. Everybody else, it was believed, felt the duty, felt the civic obligation to participate in some way in Athens. When our founders then talked about democracy, just like those in England and European countries in the 16th and 17th centuries talked about democracy, that's what they had in mind, direct democracy or pure democracy. And what could be more pure than all the people coming together in the ecclesia to discuss and debate issues, or to participate in the great juries of the day? The way you knew if a great trial was important was to be measured by the number of people who served on the jury. So the Socrates, maybe the most famous trial in the history of all Athens, there were 1,501 jurors. Now, I know you're going to say, how in the world did they ever do any work? But it was testimony to the Athenian sense of the importance that they wanted to have widespread discussion and debate. That's how our founders conceived of democracy. Now, you can understand that as James Madison, justly known as the father of the Constitution, introduced his plan to the Constitutional Convention in May of 1787, when the delegates began to assemble in Philadelphia, that he already knew that it was not possible to establish in America a democracy, not as the world had come to know what constituted a democracy. He himself said, we are already too large to have a democracy. Even at that point, we had 3 million people. How could we build a stadium, a setting on the side of a hill to accommodate 3 million people? He said it was not practical. Thomas Jefferson would say it was not feasible to have a democracy. When framer after framer and people outside the convention then commented on the kind of system that they wanted to have, they agreed we could not have a democracy in the Greek sense. We were already too large. More than that, as Madison explained, the very size of the United States created a problem as far as he was concerned, because having read the literature about government, and he was the most scholarly of scholars in the Constitutional Convention, he came to the belief that, in fact, it was very, very difficult to govern a nation that already extended over so many tens of thousands of miles. And he wondered, how do we govern that if we're going to be efficient? And how can we possibly govern the country if we do it in some sort of, in a way consistent with democracy? It was impossible. And so he said, and this was the key, to Madison's view of government. We have to focus on representation. We need representation on different levels. We're going to have representation on the national level, representation on the state level, and, of course, representation on lower levels. The key for him was to establish a representative democracy. Now, how would this work? He would again acknowledge it could not be a democracy in the sense that the Athenians understood it, and all other scholars understood the term in the centuries since. But a representative democracy would promote the interests of the people because their views would be promoted, advanced, argued for by their representatives, their elected representatives. If you cannot bring all the people together to discuss and debate the issues, Madison figured you need the next best form, and that is to assure that the views and values of the citizens are represented. Now, how to accomplish that? Here we turn to another chapter in the book of American Democracy to understand how our founders viewed efficient, desirable government. As they grew up, as they cut their teeth on the literature describing government, we might say, they were children of an approach that suggested that the mixed state or a mixed system of government was by far the wisest, the very kind to which we aspired. Where in the world did they come to embrace this idea that the best, most preferable system of government was a mixed state? Of course, from the Athenians. Madison and the others and all scholars throughout Europe turned back to Aristotle once more to understand how Aristotle described government. And you may well know that Aristotle said there are three forms of government. There are three parts of government. There would be essentially the monarchy. There, at one level, there would be the aristocracy, and then there would be the commoners represented in a mixed form of government. The monarch or the king at one level, the aristocrats at another, the nobles, we might say, and at the other level, the last level, would be the people themselves, the commoners. Aristotle's scheme for governments advocated a mixed state because he said, any one of these three kinds of government, a monarchy, an aristocracy, or a democracy, by itself will collapse at some point, or in his terms, it will be perverted. He said, for example, a kingship will be perverted into a tyranny. Why would it be perverted into a tyranny? Because he understood that people in power want power. The more they have, the more they want. It's an insatiable appetite. So the king, who sets out to do good things, and there were many great kings in the history of Greek, they became corrupt over time. They acquired more power. They ignored the restraints imposed upon their office. Aristotle, who was, by the way, initially a biologist, who became the world's first political scientist. Now, there's a smart man, I say as a footnote. A man who leaves the practice of medicine to practice politics, or else he is inviting a lifetime full of frustration, isn't he? He knew that the way to understand any organism or institution, he wrote, was to study its origin and development. So as he studied animals in his time, he studied their origin and development. When he began to study politics, what he would refer to as the science of politics, he began to examine the different forms of government, their origin, and how they developed, how they became corrupt over time. So the kingship then becomes corrupt. It becomes a tyranny. The aristocracy collapses into an arbitrary form of government in which the nobles or the aristocrats, once united on a common cause and a program to pursue, become divided over their respective points of greed, their own selfish interests. It deteriorates into an arbitrary form of government. And what about democracy? Well, all the people, once united in working on behalf of the interests of all the people, once they acquire power, they too begin to develop many different views and values as they seek more and more power. So the theme here, ladies and gentlemen, is even at that time, Aristotle understood, and we've all embraced it ever since, that people in power want more power. The more power they get, the more they want. And of course, power corrupts. And as Lord Acton said, absolute power corrupts absolutely. By the way, scholars who write in the field of political theory often have said over the years that everything since Aristotle and Plato is mere embroidery. A little bit of an exaggeration, but not too much. These men who had a great deal to say 2,500 years ago are still the reference points for issues such as and topics such as those we're discussing tonight. So as Aristotle then describes the idea of a mixed government, because the three ideal forms of government cannot last very long, he says, let's put them together. Let's have the mixed government reflecting the interest of society. The poor people will be represented, the aristocrats, the rich people will be represented, and of course, the king would be represented. Here we would strive for what was urged in the name of balance or equipoise. Mix not only the three estates, but in effect reflective also of the different levels of people in society. Aristotle thought this is how you get a government that will be stable and will avoid revolution. Why was avoiding revolution so important? Because as he examined the world, he knew that ultimately every state goes through or endures the throes of revolution. It cannot be helped. So as the ultimate political scientist, he was looking for a way to establish a stable regime. The mixed state was the answer. When European political scientists or scholars began to write about government, they picked up Aristotle centuries later. And so the great English writers who influenced the American founders were of the same mind. And in the British Constitution, which was, of course, the source of America's learning and teaching and experience about constitutions and government, the British Constitution was praised everywhere as the finest constitution, the finest form of government ever established. That's how John Adams in our country and Alexander Hamilton and founder after founder viewed the English Constitution. It was the very best that any man could create. That was a problem when we began to revolt against England in the early 1770s, leading to the Declaration of Independence in 1776, because if England has the very best government that could ever be created, why in the world do you want to revolt against that government? That was an issue. So the founder said, we're not opposed to that system of government. We're opposed to the fact that the English have abandoned it. The English are violating their constitution, which is our constitution. And if we were going off into another direction, which we're not in this series, we would say that the colonists here in America began to complain about the fact that the English government was now violating the rights of Englishmen under the English Constitution and natural rights enjoyed by American colonists, and that Parliament was behaving arbitrarily, and so too was the king. So the fault lay not in the system of a mixed government. The fall lay in the operation of government by men, always men, in England, positions in power, who were themselves becoming corrupt. And so it became the overwhelming theme for American colonists. Everybody in England is corrupt. They're abusing power. They're not doing their duties. They're not carrying out their responsibilities. They're not adhering to the laws. And certainly, they are ignoring our rights and liberties. And that provided the fuel for the American Revolution. After we won the American Revolution, and you heard it here first, we won. After we won the American Revolution, now the great task, of course, was to create our own form of government. And don't you all think it's one thing to criticize the status quo? It's another thing to write your own constitution, create your own governmental form. And that was the task, of course, that the American colonists faced in the days and years after 1776. They naturally started with the idea that they would advance the very system that was employed in England. Why wouldn't we, when in fact that was the system, the only system that we'd known? As the state constitutions began to try to apply those very principles, however, state constitution writers from Virginia through Maryland into New England realized that they had a problem, and that was because America now had embraced Republican principles, the mixed state was no longer going to work. The form was not going to work because, number one, we weren't going to have a monarchy. There was not going to be a kingship in America. So lop off the idea of a monarch in America. Well, that means we only have two other branches of government, if you will, two other estates represented. The aristocracy, well, now wait a minute, we just won a revolution in the name of the rights of the people. We're not going to accept a hereditary aristocracy, which was the theme in England and across Europe. So lop off that idea. Well, that just leaves the last estate, that of the commoners. Is it possible to create a system based on the rule of the people, or as Lincoln would later say, of the people, by the people, and for the people? This is what the state constitution writers were looking at in the 1770s, late 1770s, early 1780s. Well, of course that sounded great. There was Thomas Paine, who had been the great pamphleteer in 1776, driving Americans to embrace the cause of revolution to begin with, when he said that resorting to revolution is simply a matter of common sense. And he himself had vigorously attacked the mixed state. He said that could never apply in America. And James Wilson and others now who are becoming leaders would say the mixed state cannot apply to America. What do we do when that was the science of politics, understood the world over, going all the way back to the writings of Aristotle? Wow, now we've got to roll up our sleeves and start rethinking what we mean by government in America and these Republican principles. So the Americans then began to somehow embrace the concept of popular sovereignty. We take that for granted today. Popular sovereignty refers to the fact that the ultimate governmental power is vested solely and exclusively in the American people. And that's because the term sovereign, which is a very important word in the worlds of political science and law, refers to the ultimate power in any state. In another country, that could be a king or a queen. It could be a body of people. But here in America, we the people are sovereign. But to say that then begs the question for our American forebears. That sounds good. The people are sovereign. But who are the people? Who do we mean by the people? It looked good on paper, and it surely provided the basis for a great speech. But who are the people, and how do we implement this? Could we have the views of the people represented in what were formerly all three estates, in the legislature, in the executive, in the judiciary? Wait a minute, we would then fear that the values and viewpoints of all the commoners would not necessarily be good for America if their views and their values were the only ones put into the place of governance. How to protect against the possibility then that there would be an overrepresentation of the views of the commoners. Others said, we don't have to worry about that. What we have to worry about is that we have representation for all people in American government. And that's what turned the question back for James Madison in the run-up to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, which was that critical issue of representation. This would allow us to move past the old science of politics, which was all about the mixed state. Here's how we're going to do it, as Madison laid it out in his plan to the convention. The people would directly elect members of the House of Representatives, as you know. The state legislature would be directly elected by people, and then the state legislatures would then elect the members of the United States Senate representing their particular states. There would not be then a direct vote by the American people for their U.S. senators. That would come much later in the form of the 17th Amendment in 1913, but we're a long way from that. And then, of course, the framers would create a very strange, awkward institution called the Electoral College, which would give the people a role in selecting their president, but certainly not a direct role, rather providing an opportunity for the states, and as you'll see later, more importantly, giving an opportunity to those people who are electors in the Electoral College to select that person whom they consider to be best qualified for the office, somewhat remote from the people, obviously in the selection process, but focusing directly on what the framers' great concern was about the selection of the president, and that was to have people who had firsthand knowledge of the credentials, the qualifications, the skill set of those who were candidates for the presidency. They would make that decision rather than Americans who would be casting about in the dark as if they voted for the president because we didn't have a national newspaper, we didn't have NPR, no CNN. So to inform the people about the candidates, and the founders feared that the voters in the respective states or the respective regions of the country would have knowledge only of those candidates and could not look beyond their own favorite son, and thus they would not be making an informed choice. Thus, the framers then, as we'll see later, rejected the concept of a direct popular vote, but instead embraced the Electoral College as something that was better than nothing. Let me leave it in that shorthand way, and we'll come back to that later. So here was Madison's scheme then laid before the convention, promoting representation. And his belief was, as long as the people felt they were represented, then we could have something approaching harmony in the nation. So let's be clear then that the founders rejected the concept of a direct democracy. And that was the only way they understood the term in their time. But what they were embracing was very much, in effect, a representative democracy, as Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Paine, very different souls, spelled out. Americans in letters, in correspondence, and in letters to the editor, waxed eloquent about our great American democracy. That's how they would describe America. But it would not be the way that scholars or political scientists would understand that term. It had a limited utility. Does it matter whether we refer to America at the start as a democracy or a republic? It matters to those who fill the pages of our local newspaper, but it would not have mattered to the framers. Democracy and the term republicanism were synonyms for the very people who created the system. But even if we were merely a republic, however that's to be distinguished from a democracy, It didn't take long before the American people, utilizing the very mechanisms and features in the Constitution that was written by the framers and ratified by the people, began to use those mechanisms to make America a much more democratic system than it was at the founding. To say that America became more democratic than it was in 1787 is rather easy, because any time we look at the definition and the operation of democracy, we realize that our democracy in 1787 was pretty limited. You don't need me to remind you that women had no role, that certainly African Americans had no role, and so we had a racist, sexist government established at the outset, and over time, the American people, through their demands, would achieve a much more democratic system by utilizing Article 5 of the Constitution, which is the amendatory clause, inserted by the framers, not because they were arrogant, who believed that they had all answers for all time, but on the contrary, inserted Article 5 because they wanted to leave to subsequent generations of Americans the opportunity to improve upon their work. They understood that even though they had tried as hard as they could, and they had produced a marvelous constitution, nevertheless, it had many imperfections and flaws. And so, as Ben Franklin himself said, we leave it to the American people to improve upon our work. And so, how has the Constitution been amended over the course of 200 years to create a much more democratic system? Consider at the outset the adoption of the Bill of Rights, introduced by the first Congress in 1789, ratified by the American people, implemented in 1791, really just an appendage to the original Constitution, a set of proposed amendments that were demanded by the American people, and the demands were so persuasive that James Madison agreed that if, in fact, he were elected to the first Congress, and he would be a candidate from Virginia, if he were elected, that he would indeed introduce a Bill of Rights. It's a fascinating story how we came to write and adopt the Bill of Rights. But Madison, true to his word, did introduce the Bill of Rights in June of 1789. And included in the Bill of Rights were principles and freedoms and liberties that could broaden the opportunity for Americans to participate. Consider, for example, in the First Amendment, guarantee of freedom of speech, as well as freedom of the press. When you stop and ask yourselves this question, were the founders opposed after the adoption of the Bill of Rights, if not sooner, were the founders opposed to participation in government by average, ordinary Americans? Were they elitists? Were they elitists who did not want to hear from the commoners? If the answers to those questions are yes, then you would ask, then why did they guarantee free speech and freedom of the press? Because they were opening Pandora's box. They were giving to Americans of all stripes and viewpoints the opportunity to weigh in. A group of people who were committed only to government by the elites, not interested in allowing commoners to participate, never would have included the opportunity, the guarantee, in fact, in the First Amendment for people to weigh in by expressing their views and ideas and criticizing government through freedom of the press. The Bill of Rights as a whole, then, opened a broad door to more democratic participation. As you go through the decades in American history, you see the expansion of the franchise to African Americans in the 15th Amendment, to later the right of women to the vote, right of 18-year-olds to vote. We see, moreover, the move from indirect election of our U.S. senators to direct election in the form of the 17th Amendment in 1913. For many Americans, that was knocking down barriers to the opportunity of the American people to have a direct influence on the United States Senate. And I think you'll agree, if in fact you have the opportunity to vote for your senator, you're going to have the opportunity to hold that senator much more accountable than if the senators were elected by state legislatures. And so across the decades, indeed across two centuries, America has become much more democratic. But our discussion of democracy would not stop there, because we have more to say about the nature of our democracy than merely focusing on the constitutional nature of it. And it's certainly fair and proper to say that we are a constitutional democracy, because, in fact, the Constitution governs all the actions of the government. But if we were to cut down two or three layers and we were to probe the quality or the vitality or even the integrity of American democracy, we would ask ourselves, does America possess the three conditions that scholars often say are necessary if a nation wants to regard itself as a democracy? Those conditions would be a set of social conditions, economic conditions, and political conditions. Social, economic, and political conditions. We're going to talk in more detail about this in the coming weeks, because we want to examine whether or not America satisfies these conditions. But let me introduce these elements to you very quickly, and you can be thinking about it as you lie awake tonight with insomnia, wondering, is America a democracy or not? When we talk about social conditions, we always say no country can be a democracy unless the citizenry has renounced violence as a way of changing its politics. Because in those countries that would aspire to be democratic, where assassinations are fairly frequent, that would mean that that has a chilling effect upon the participation of people in politics. Do I dare run for office in a South American country or an Asian country if I know there's a fairly good chance that I'm going to be killed when I become a candidate or when I'm elected to office? The absence of a commitment to peaceful transition to power, and even more importantly, the absence of tolerance of different viewpoints, would preclude a great many countries on Earth from dreaming of becoming a democracy. To put it in a very simple way, political violence, and specifically assassination, tends to short-circuit participation in politics. Where does America stand on this question of violence in our midst? We have a tragic history of assassination. We could start at any point in our history, but the notable assassinations would, of course, include Abraham Lincoln and John and Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and others. But the level of political violence in America has grown by the number of murders committed by handguns and other weapons of choice. Think about that. We're coming back to that later. If a nation wants to become a democracy, moreover, it has to have certain economic conditions that prevail. What might those be? If you consider that the essence of democracy is that we want as many people as possible to participate in government, to engage in discussion and debate, to be vigorous, active citizens, then the one qualification that must obtain is that people do not have to spend their time searching for their next meal, do not have to spend their time looking for a way to put a roof over their head, do not have to spend their time wondering, can they have treatment for a medical illness or condition? Because those people can't participate in politics. Why not? Because for whatever other reasons that might obtain, they're not going to have time to become informed. How can they possibly read newspapers, follow the news, learn about the issues before our government if their greatest concern each and every day is finding their next meal? It simply will not be. And if you multiply that for all the people who find themselves in those difficult conditions, trying to eat, trying to find shelter, trying to find medical care, multiply that by the millions, it undercuts Aristotle's very basic description of democracy, that democracy is government by the many. Instead, eliminating all those people who are trapped by poverty or not even officially in poverty, but work two or three jobs because they have to make ends meet, those people don't have time to become informed, active citizens. There are other economic conditions we'll turn to later as well. And then finally, certain political conditions must obtain. Scholars who write about democracy agree on this. The political conditions must mean that once people have reached the age of maturation under the law, that they have a right to vote, that the government, governing bodies at any level, cannot implement mechanisms or policies or even laws that would thwart the constitutional right of American citizens to vote. You know our history of how pretty clever politicians over the centuries have found ways initially to deprive African Americans of the right to vote and women the right to vote. And now we have states undertaking efforts to prevent others from voting. So voter suppression laws would strike at the heart of those political conditions that must obtain if we want to become a democracy. That very brief description, then, is just meant as an appetizer for what comes later. So as we review what Aristotle would require us to review, the origin and development of America, and we say that at the beginning, it did not matter to the founders whether they described American government as a republic or democracy or as a representative democracy. And certainly we agree that over the course of 200 years, America has become much more democratic by broadening the franchise and allowing more people to participate. Does it really matter to us tonight if we want to ask democracy or republic, Grenada or Granada, tomato or tomato? Thank you. Now, I would love to hear your questions, but promise you're not going to throw tomatoes at the speaker. We would ask that. So let's have a discussion. Kelly has got the microphone. I want to thank KISU for recording this. By the way, take a look at the Alturas Institute website, and we'll have that date on there. So please, yes, we have a, where are you? Where's the, oh, there, okay, great.
So if there's not, based on what you're saying, there's not really much difference between a republic and a democracy as in this country, why is it so important to those other people who keep touting republic, republic, republic?
Thank you. And I was certain that somebody would ask that question. I'm very glad you did. So that it gives me the segue to that very subject. In our editorial pages over the last few months, you've seen people weigh in and insist that we're a republic, not a democracy. It has everything to do, I believe, with the idea of limiting the number of people who can participate in our political system. And their particular concern is focused on ballot measures, on initiatives, on referendums. And, of course, this was sparked, I'm sure, by the second initiative on Medicaid expansion. Now, let me say, in fairness, to be completely fair, there would be a great many people who would have grown up taking classes, reading textbooks, who were told that America was a republic at the beginning and maybe still is a republic. And let's say that that continues to be taught. Nothing wrong with that. It's just that we ought not to become too upset about it when we remember that our own founders used those terms, republic and democracy, as synonyms. So they would not be offended. You would not have offended Alexander Hamilton or Thomas Paine or James Madison in 1787 if you'd called America a representative democracy or a republic or democracy. It would not have mattered. But in our time, when it becomes an edge issue for many people, I think it has to do initially with the idea of trying to block the significance of an initiative widely embraced by Idahoans, 60% or so, involving Medicaid expansion, to suggest that it is merely a suggestion to the legislature, take it or leave it, ignore it, that the people don't have any significance when they are outside the legislature. I think that's it. So these people on the outside, sure, they have a viewpoint, but they don't really know how government works. They don't know the ins and outs of Medicaid. So their views are rather inferior. Let's not let those inferior views and values color the wiser, far-reaching views and values of those in the legislature. I think that has a lot to do with it. But what they ignored, and I wrote an op-ed on this some weeks ago, what they ignored is that our own founders embraced the idea of people participating in a legislative process while they were, quote, unquote, out of doors. The phrase was formed at the founding, out of doors politics. That was the alternative to legislation being drafted by people who were forgetting the interest of the people, who were ignoring the views, the values, the preferences of American citizens. And all of the good Whigs who wrote our Constitution, adopted it, and governed in the early years of the Republic were in favor of having people participate in what we call out-of-doors conventions. This worked on political issues. It worked on economic issues. It worked for candidacies. The Constitution itself is, frankly, an out-of-doors activity because, of course, while the members of the Annapolis Convention in 1786 wrote a letter to the Congress and said, pass a bill to hold the Constitutional Convention in the spring of 1787, these were people pushing Congress, which had been ignoring the requests and the views of a great many Americans, to hold the Constitutional Convention. These were the efforts of many leading statesmen in America at that time, including Hamilton and Madison and Franklin and Washington, who were putting pressure on Congress to pass the right kind of legislation. That was an out-of-doors activity. So we could say, in many ways, that our greatest accomplishment in this country of writing a constitution was a function of people who were outside the legislative arena. So when we consider that our own founders then believed very strongly in the right of the people to challenge the legislature on the grounds that the legislature was not representing the views and the values of the people, then we see the initiative process as falling precisely in that great tradition where Idaho voters would say the legislature is not adequately representing Idaho values. Any response to that? Equal time here. We have a democracy. I mean a republic. I mean a representative democracy. Kelly, you back in the back row. Thank you.
From the purposes of most states have the ability to have referendums or initiatives or something like that. The United States in whole does not have that.
Right.
How did the folks that framed the original state constitutions that included referendums and initiatives comes up with the idea to do that when it's not covered at all in the big one?
Thank you very much. An excellent question. The tradition of initiatives or referenda on ballots is really the handiwork of progressives in the early 20th century. Some resort to that method appeared in the 19th century, but it really became a common practice in the early 20th century as a progressive measure at a time in which many people across the country believed that legislatures controlled by corporations, by railroads, and entrenched capitalistic interests were passing laws that ignored the interests of the commoners. And so that gives rise to what we call the progressive movement that ushered in some of the great social legislation in our country, including protection for children. It would later give rise to minimum wage, right of labor to unionize, etc. Those were extra efforts taken because the legislature, again, was ignoring the views and the values of people outside the legislative arena, the out of doors. So it was an act by the sovereign people. Here we come back to we the people, the sovereign people saying all government rests ultimately on the sovereign people. And when the legislatures ignore the views and the values, the needs, the desires of the electorate, then they are not living up to their responsibilities. Stronger measures are necessary. And that means that we've got to provide additional methods for people to change the laws in their states. The additional question we would ask, well, how come Congress has never provided the opportunity for a national referendum? The answer to that can be seen in the fact that in 1912, when the citizens of Colorado brought an initiative to take away judicial review from the Colorado courts, that was tested in the courts, and the Colorado Supreme Court held it unconstitutional. The judges did not want to lose their power of judicial review. Congress does not want to lose its power over the lawmaking. It's a little bit of a quibble. But the reality is Congress would never embrace that because it passes laws that are the supreme law of the land and believe that it still represents the people. So we don't have an initiative process, but we hope that we can find ways to put pressure on Congress to change its policies and laws. A very receptive, accountable Congress. Kelly, please. Oh, yes.
The presence of tribalism, greed, and Citizens United would lead me to wonder whether a republic or a democracy can survive in those conditions as exists today.
Right. That's an excellent question, and one that we'll continue to examine in the weeks ahead. And you'll get a real answer to that in week four, so I hope you come back. That's not fair. You asked the ultimate question, can America survive? Can American democracy survive? It's a very real question because the way you described it, tribalism represents a grave threat to democracy. If James Madison were addressing that, he would say, of course it does, because our system, as Madison explained in Federalist Number 10 and elsewhere, rests on the idea that there is an identifiable common interest, a public interest, one declared in the Constitution as the general welfare. When we agree that there is something identifiable as the public interest, we expect our legislators to act in a way to achieve that common interest and to implement it. Tribalism, disunity, tears away at the fibers and the very concept of the general interest, people advancing their own selfish interest. We have a long history, of course, of legislators advancing their own interests, perhaps doing the good work of special interest groups and so forth. And it reminds us that Madison himself wanted to distinguish between the general interest, or what he said was the public good, and those selfish interests. How to find a remedy? He wrote in the Federalist Papers, this is going to be hard for us to believe, he wrote in the Federalist Papers that, in fact, members of Congress should even be willing to vote against their state's interest on behalf of the national interest. Because occasionally factions could build up within a state that would work to undermine the national interest. Let's say that's a possibility. He would say that members of Congress have a duty to advance the national interest over and above the state interest. That's on paper. That's a theory. But I would ask you, how many people running for Congress are going to be successful candidates if they say, no matter what all of you want, I'm going to vote on behalf of the national interest? Or would we Idahoans, like citizens in other states, say, no, we want you to represent the interests of our states? You see that maybe Madison's approach there was not grounded in reality, or else we might say the failure of members of Congress to understand and to identify the national interest and work on that on behalf of that as a way of avoiding the factions or what you call the tribalism. So that would be Madison's view. Daniel, please. Oh, I'm sorry. Please. Yeah.
Yeah. You've made mention through the evening about rights. Mm-hmm. I'll try to make this fairly succinct, but how are rights determined as our country evolves? And I'll ask the very specific question because you had mentioned it earlier. We have the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments that basically say that we are should be provided the right to free speech, the right to pursue religion, the right to bear arms, not self-incriminate. But here recently, for the last 10, 15 years, this right of health care is becoming quite prominent. And in discussions that we've had at home, we kind of disagree with the health care thing. Because under the Bill of Rights, with the exception of taxes that would need to be required, taken by the state to provide certain things like the court system, healthcare requires somebody else to utilize their labor, their knowledge, their capital to provide a service to another. So how is something along those lines a right versus, as my wife put it this morning, an obligation to the general welfare that you mentioned a second ago?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So first we would say that rights can be established in a number of ways. One is through, as you pointed out, the amendatory clause. We create new rights beyond the Bill of Rights. We expand the franchise, rights for women to vote, 18-year-olds, et cetera. So the amendatory clause is a very good way to do that. A second way would be, of course, for Congress to simply pass a statute guaranteeing universal health care, and then nobody could be denied universal health care because to be denied it would be to deny them their what we would call their statutory privilege to a right. And the Supreme Court over the years has said where a statute creates a right, then nobody can be denied access to that right. So that could be done. But you're asking a very interesting question about the politics behind the declaration, the creation, really, of a right and the many competing concerns. So when we address that issue of the creation of, let's say, national health care bill guaranteeing single payer or however, whatever form it takes, that would be a determination that Congress believes it's in the general welfare, it's in the national interest for people to pay a share, a percentage of their revenue, so as to guarantee health care for all Americans. And there are many different systems. Some of you are familiar with other systems, the Canadian system, system in Germany, elsewhere. And we could, that really becomes an administrative matter. How are we going to do it? How are we going to implement it? But the initial determination is that it should be a right. So when you ask how is that to be accomplished, it means it would be a majority of members of Congress, both houses, the president signing such a bill, saying that we now declare it's a right. If you wonder, is that imposing an unfair burden on others, we would then think of the fact that taxes are used to buy civilization, as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes says, a New Englander. And he said, of course, that he likes his taxes to buy civilization. He doesn't want to pay any more taxes than he has to, but he wants to pay enough to get what we need to create a civilized country. So we would then look at the taxes that support Social Security. There's a burden on current workers to pay those on Social Security. We would look at Medicare, for example. We would look at Medicaid. So our system is full of different taxes, different statutes to provide rights or the welfare of others, even if it imposes a burden on the rest of us. And, of course, ultimately we see that in the area of defense as well. So we all pay taxes, and it creates a great military machine. So when people start parceling out the way tax dollars are spent, then we're participating in the great arena of American politics. Too much taxes, not taxes for this program or that program. But in theory, in a Madisonian democracy, when people are paying taxes, we're paying them because Congress has determined through a statute that, in fact, that statute is promoting the national good. Yeah, good question. Thank you. Please, yes.
I'm Daniel here.
Daniel.
David, I may have misunderstood you, but you seem to imply that economic well-being is a precondition to good democracy. Mm. If you look at the Athenians, they had many more slaves than they had citizens. And that is true even at the time of the founding fathers, that a slavery was an institution that guaranteed economic prosperity, or at least contributed to economic prosperity, as opposed to everybody else. So as we see the economy of this country deteriorating to the point where not everybody can afford everything, and you also see the gig economy and so on moving away from the traditional right to employment, do you see that as a symptom of our economy, of our democracy deteriorating, or do you see that as being corrected in some other way?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. So first, you didn't like the movie version of the Athenian democracy that I sketched out when you mentioned slavery. So yes, there are many black marks against the Athenian democracy, one of which, of course, is that they were sexist. Secondly, the fact is they practiced slavery. It wasn't racial slavery. It was the fact that Athens had the most powerful navy, bless you, had the most powerful navy in the world. And when they won a victory, the losing side was enslaved. So to the victors belong the spoils? I don't know. Anyway, that form of slavery did enable the Athenians to implement some of the very practices that I mentioned, including farm labor, so that they could invite many different views and voices into the political arena. All of that aside, when you ask that general question about the condition of the American economy and its relationship to democracy, the answer is you bet. If in fact we have high unemployment or we have people who are underpaid, then they can't participate as fully as those who are comfortable, have what Thomas Hobbes and other English theorists described as the invaluable leisure time necessary to be vigorously involved. The leisure class in England in the 17th century could be described as the most effective participants precisely because they had time to read, they had time to write. Not everybody enjoys those. Now, we can't hope to level the playing field, not the political field or the economic field, but we aim to provide more people with those basic needs in life so they can give some thought to what our legislature is doing, what the president might be doing, to legislative reforms. We want that. Otherwise, we are making we're shrinking the participation level in our country. And that itself is a political question, isn't it? Minimum wage goes to that question, whether or not it helps to provide more opportunities for people to participate, and a good many other issues that we could talk about as a means of trying to improve the quality of life, the fundamental well-being, the general welfare of individuals so that they can, in fact, participate. Yeah, thank you. Please,
another
Dr.
excellent
Schill.
Lecture.
Thank you.
I want you to defend the notion that more participation equals better democracy under the following discussion.
Okay.
That when we realize that most people who are in favor that think campaign finance reform is very important, that's under the notion that, you know, political advertising and giving more speech to different people sways the voting public in ways that they would not be voting otherwise. Similarly, the Russia investigation, we're not worried that the Russians were stuffing ballots. We were worried that the Russians were advertising in such ways that was tilting the election in favor of a television celebrity.
Yeah.
So if there's, I don't think that people who spend their evenings and spend $10 to come to constitutional lectures really think that their vote is being swayed by advertising. But we all probably believe that there's a large subset of the voting public whose vote really is swayed in that way. So with that view, why is more participation better?
This sounds like a really tough test question. I'm so sorry that our time has been exhausted. So that is a fun question. I like that. So if we took the view from Aristotle, for example, that we want all views represented, it's because our system's going to be better because then it is a system that represents the views of the poor, the middle class, the rich. Now, there's not anything that is quintessentially better for that system than simply a system of government in which the very wise, knowledgeable people are ruling. It's just we prefer it. We start with that initial value that we want the views and values of all people to be represented. So that's our first bias. We have to start somewhere with a prejudice. So that would be Aristotle's prejudice. We want all voices included. That would be mine as well. If you ask why, then it goes to the necessary ingredients of government to promote democratic freedoms, which would include recognition and respect for human dignity. We don't want to be ruled in a democracy. We want to be governed. There's a very different concept, isn't there? In a kingship, you're ruled. In Plato's great elitist system, you're told what to think. In a totalitarian system, which we all abhor, you're told what to believe, what to think. So embracing that first square, that we believe that human beings have a right to fundamental human dignity, we say that representation in government is a must. It's necessary. It may not lead to better government. Does it lead to increased participation if people know that they can participate? Not necessarily, because we only have 51% of the people participating. So does that mean that people themselves don't even value the right to vote? Probably. Does it mean that they don't even care about what government is doing in the form of policies and laws and regulations that affect their lives? Probably not. Now I'm making the case against democracy and for an elitist system, right? So when we then ask that other part of your question, which is the most important, and that is, do people realize that we are being swayed by advertising? Scholarly studies demonstrate emphatically, yes, we are. That's how we buy cookies and cars and clothing and why we're choosing this product over the other. Some of it is very obvious. A lot of it is subliminal. We're not even aware of the impact of television advertising and the effect of the media on our lives. That does not happen to be an area that I am particularly studying or ever have studied, but there are those who are media specialists who have made a lifetime of examining the impact of advertising on our choices, why we think the way we do. It's not anything new to us. If you think about, a lot of you have read George Orwell's famous book, 1984. What better way to demonstrate the impact of demagoguery and what the state tells people to think and the advertising that the people see on their screen 24/7, or I like it best, when the voice comes directly to you on television? We know that people are affected by advertising. Now, the question is, if we're affected by advertising, do we really want rules and laws that would inhibit campaign expenditures, which might stop some people or diminish the role that some people can play in trying to persuade us that candidate A is better than candidate B? Why would we want to limit that, you might ask? Well, what we would want to say in response is that we fear that those who have more dollars to spend on television advertising are going to be more effective than the people who have fewer dollars. And that takes us back to square one and takes us back to Aristotle, which means all views are not going to get equal representation. That takes us back to the importance and the vitality of democratic theory. That's what I would say. What kind of grade would you give me for that?
I think it was a good A minus.
An A minus, thank you. Well, then, I appreciate that, Professor. I'm going to work on that. I'm going to come back with a better answer then. Thank you. That was a fun question. Do we have any other fun questions here? Let's go right here and then over here. Where are you, Kelly? Okay. Oh, yeah, thank you. Okay.
Thank you. David, having participated in the newspaper discussions...
Yes, you have.
Sitting down, thinking and framing and thinking why I want to have this discussion, I looked at the people that said it's a republic, people that said it's a democracy. We can look and tomatoes, tomatoes, maybe one or the other. We can look and see around through time and across different countries. We can see good ones and bad ones for both. You know, I'm sure the Russians think that they were doing democracy, right? They voted in Vladimir. The Chinese probably think they're doing some kind of a mm-hmm. democracy or republic form of government. They got voted in. But what really struck me in all of the discussion wasn't the type of government, but how people were seeing it. And what really bothered me and drove me to write was essentially paternalism. Mm-hmm. As I was listening to the debates and the discussions and doing the reading, what I heard was people saying... this is a representative government. You have elected me. You've elected me to choose how we go forward from here. I make the decision. You decided that I will be a good representative and go about this in an honest and fair way, mm-hmm. but using my judgment, right? To me, a good republic government requires that they are informed what the people want and need, and that they are meeting what the people want and need. They're not substituting what their needs and desires, what they want, for what the people want and need. So that was a fundamental difference, and it didn't matter which side you're on, because you can implement either of those in a good or a bad way.
Right.
But how I was hearing the discussion here in River City was that we were trying to set up a paternalistic government that's going to decide for me what's good for me.
Right. Thank you. That is a very good review, and I appreciate your analysis of that, Jerry. When you make those points, what you're really doing is to plumb the depths of the historic discussion on what we mean by representation and what kind of representation we want. These were issues that plagued our founders. We could take many hours to talk about this concept of the most desirable representation we have. Again, understanding that James Madison was talking about a representative democracy, the key is to represent all people. Historically, going back at least to the 16th century in England, great debates emerged about what kind of representation representatives owed their citizens. Here's why. In England, particularly as it was articulated in the 17th and 18th century, the idea was those who are elected are sent to utilize their knowledge, their expertise, their experience to make the best decisions for the entire country. And that meant that while certainly people could weigh in, we could all suggest views and positions to the legislator, that in fact he should feel free to ignore our views because he's elected, again, to make the best decisions for the English Empire. That became known as the Burkean model after the famous legislator Edmund Burke. That ran in contrast to the historic notion of representation in England, which does go back to the 15th century. And that is the idea of a legislator behaving simply as a mirror for the views, wishes, and values of the people, meaning the legislator would not exercise discretion in terms of where to stand on a bill or a proposition, although or else it would be very minor. Rather, once the legislator, the representative, heard from the constituency where the constituents stand on a bill, then that is the very clear duty of the legislator. So do you want the mirror theory of representation, which would allow all of us to treat our representative as our hired attorney, for example? Or do we want a Burkean representative who's going to listen to you but nevertheless make the final decision based on what he or she thinks is best for the country? Our founders, in the argument against England, said, well, of course we want the mirror theory. It sells well when you're trying to revolt against a country for ignoring your wishes, your values, right? But as soon as we create our own system, oh, no, we need the Burkean model. But it's not that simple, because then historically, in any given year, in any congressional session, you all know we'll hear arguments. The member of Congress has to implement our views, or the member of Congress needs to listen to the voters through an initiative. It's a centuries-old argument. There's no clear answer as to how much weight should be given the views of the citizenry outside your own value system. And that's where we are today as well. Should we build a wall? And this not, that's a rhetorical question. Please, it's a rhetorical question. Yes. Thank you. And it's worthy of many hours of discussion, and it goes deeper into the question of whether or not we should have a unicameral or a bicameral legislature. At the time of the founding, the operative theory was a unicameral legislature was just fine, because after all, if we elected representatives to represent the views of the country, to create yet another branch would seem a concession to the argument that the unicameral branch was not really representative if we need two branches. And then what happens when we have a bicameral legislature, two different chambers, and they may disagree on how best to represent the people? Well, then we're lost in this muck. Where is the view of the people? Where's the best representation? So we can tie ourselves in knots, or we can chase our tails around the stump all day long on those issues, but they're fun to talk about. Where are we, Kelly? I have a question. Oh, right over here, please. Just about out of time, a time for another fun question. Please, thank you.
Somebody earlier had mentioned Citizens United, and in your presentation, you keep referring back to people and individuals. And I've been a bit befuddled since the Citizen United case of how under the construct of our Constitution do you believe that the Supreme Court looked at a non-human entity as having rights to influence the electoral process?
Yeah, I love that question. Thank you. So you're right about Citizens United and the court's view that corporations have the right of free speech. In a subsequent case, the court would say that a corporation has a freedom of religion right. And so the question is, where does this stop? I don't like it. My prejudice is that corporations are established to make money. They do have limited privileges. They have commercial rights, but their rights should not be as expansive as individual rights. As Justice Ginsburg has said, she's never seen a corporation get on its knees and pray. The people in those corporations have their individual rights. The question is, should those members through their corporate activity essentially be given another right or another opportunity to exercise their rights in a corporate capacity? So my own view is that the court was engaged in what we call judicial activism, creating rights that are not founded in the Constitution. And typically, that complaint is voiced by conservatives about so-called liberal activist judges. But we should know that that works both ways, that for all of history in which citizens could condemn the Supreme Court for activism to promote liberal values, so too has the court engaged in activism to promote conservative values. And now we're swinging more toward the promotion of conservative values through the appointment by President Trump of the two most recent nominees, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. We'll see how they proceed. How this court is going to behave in the face of emerging issues involving presidential power of great importance is going to be fascinating. It'll create great pressure, and Americans will recognize what's on the line, involving perhaps the question of whether a president might be indicted, whether a president could be prosecuted, whether a president is going to be given what can invoke executive privilege to shield family members and aides from testifying. Those would just be a few questions likely to come before the court, and a number of other issues involving the scope of presidential power are on the horizon. The very question that the court addressed, except there wasn't much coverage because there couldn't be much coverage, of whether a financial institution in a foreign country, read that as Russia, can in fact be required to answer a subpoena. And when the lower federal courts ruled that the financial institution of that foreign country, not named, was required to obey the subpoena, and the appellate court ruled the same way, and just a couple of days ago the U.S. Supreme Court did as well, it's a very clear answer that, in fact, that financial the unnamed financial institution of the unnamed country has to answer the subpoena. And you don't have to connect too many dots to understand why that unnamed financial institution in the unnamed country doesn't want to have to answer the subpoena and is willing so far to pay a double fine. Initially, when it was held in contempt of court, that fine has been doubled. So I don't know how vast the resources are of the unnamed financial institution in the unnamed country, but it's paying double fines. We'll see where this goes. But my belief is that's very much linked to the Mueller report, and they're fighting like hell to resist the subpoena. Pardon? We don't know. It was just a certiorari decision, so I don't know. And time for one more question here with Ken, and then we'll wrap it up for tonight. Thank you.
Can I ask a quick question to the audience before I ask you a question?
Sure.
By a show of hands, how many people here think the Affordable Care Act is a Democratic issue, during a Democratic Party issue?
So instead of, thank you.
That it's their idea.
Yeah.
I just want to show a hand.
Yeah.
So
I appreciate,
That's not the question. I just wanted to ask the audience to find out because.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Well.
And they right. And so.
It had started with the Nixon administration first. The Nixon administration first toiled with the idea of health care.
Yeah.
Universal health care. It became a Republican idea in the 80s and 90s because the projection was that the country would go bankrupt by 2025 for oversharing. The Bush, as we affectionately called him, a Texas shrub, W., his administration asked the person I worked for, Rick Perry, who was governor at the time in the early 2000s, to implement TEST in Texas because it was the test market for most programs that go on in this country. And single payer was found to be an absolutely wonderful, low-cost method of providing health care to U.S. citizens. But because some other guy, for whatever reason, I don't know whether it was his religion, his skin tone, whatever, who finally implemented it, suddenly became a bad idea and it became a negative thing. So that's just a little history on the health care. But tribalism, let's say Jefferson and Adams could arguably be tribals. Okay, when they were founding this nation. But the one thing they had in mind, it seemed, was despite their differences, they knew that this country could be something different in the world and that it needed different representation than what was being provided by the king in England and what had gone before. But they were willing to sacrifice their lives. Most people don't realize these men were right on. I mean, if the British had just a few more minutes here and there, could have easily captured these guys and had them executed. They were not just fighting for fun. And I think their intention was that we would have intelligent people elected to office, that they would have differences, but that they would have a fundamental understanding of what this country was trying to be. Mm-hmm. And we don't teach civics anymore. And the Russians right now may have saw the opportunity, apparently, that they realize we are very easily manipulated as to what, you know, through, we read just the headlines. No one reads a book anymore. No one reads the article. And now we're just subjected to just the headline. And that makes our decision. Can democracy, our tribalism that we have now, and as I understood it from the intelligence services, that the psychological warfare unit of the Soviet Army came to Putin and said, we've got this weapon,
yeah, right,
psychologically, that we will teach Americans how we want them to vote by use of the internet. And he said, let's go, let's try it.
So
can we survive? I mean, all great, yeah, empires have come and failed. Is it just our time that we cannot survive?
That's a very, very important question. And we'll turn to that in week four. So thank you, Ken. Thanks for presaging that very important question. So we're out of time. I want to thank you all for coming out tonight and for raising these great questions. I hope you come back next week as we begin to look at the challenges and threats to American democracy. So we'll see you soon. Take care. Thank you.